So before I was sort of full-time in the meditation, doing meditation stuff, I was doing clinical research, and the group that I was working with was investigating treatments for addiction and medication. It was a medication development group that was doing clinical trials, testing medicines to see if it would help people who were addicted to methamphetamine. And in that kind of research, really the first question is, does this medicine work? Does it work? Is it effective? But then a second and also very important question is, let's say it does work, how does it work? What's the mechanism of action? To use that language, what's the mechanism of action? How is it that the medicine delivers a therapeutic effect? Right, and so those two questions, the distinction makes sense. Now, in this tradition, with medicines, there's like, okay, maybe this medicine works through serotonin pathways, right? As many antidepressants do, for example. And there are ways of experimentally manipulating so that you can actually see, okay, is the mechanism of action, is it through serotonin that this is working? Yeah. In the meditation world, there's a hypothesized mechanism of action too. How this practice gets under the skin, how it affects change. In fact, there are probably a number of mechanisms, but the main mechanism that's pointed to, the main mechanism of action of meditation, is insight. This is insight meditation practice. We're at the insight retreat center. Just the sign is small out there, like they don't want tourists, I guess, but it says it, Insight Retreat Center. And so the question is, and what is insight? What does that mean? This thing that's at the heart of how we think the practice works, how we think freedom unfolds. What is insight? Now, what I want to suggest is that insight is not so much about arriving at some ultimate metaphysical truth, but instead is very much about, it's very closely tied to reducing suffering. And so one insight teacher, Robert Bia, said that the way he defined insight was it's a seeing that brings some degree of dissolving of dukkha. So it's a seeing that brings some easing, lessening of dukkha, of suffering. Now, sometimes it seems like we understand things. It seems like we have some understanding or maybe some insight, but nothing's changing, right? Like like I definitely know patterns in myself, like historical patterns that have caused some suffering, and I think I understand them, but they have not dissolved, right? And sometimes it's said that insight is insufficient for behavior change. And an old clinical supervisor who would say is like insight is not always sufficient for behavior change. But the way the Buddhist tradition talks about insight, it almost defines insight as that which transforms. Yeah. And so the very nature of insight is transformative. And the kinds of insights that I might have about some pattern that don't transform, well, I need to keep looking. Now, one of the phenomena in working with meditators on retreat is there are kind of changes and openings and moments of people contacting, very kind of, far out, like, interesting experience. And it sometimes can be kind of hard to assess exactly what's happening, what's changed, how deep this insight is. And sometimes my tendency is not, sometimes people have really deep experience. I'm not exactly sure what's changed or what hasn't. But what seems of most interest is to see how they are in a year, in 5 years, to see what the kind of durability of that insight is, that change is. And there are some teachers who are kind of agnostic about when somebody may have had an experience, deep liberating insight, they hold a position of not knowing, and they want to see how that insight unfolds, how much freedom it brings. And so sometimes we don't even know how transformative an insight will be until we actually look back and see that some of the changes catalyzed in our lives. Now, generally, insight, it tends to come, there's a kind of emotional component usually bound up with insight. That there's something kind of surprising and relieving about insight. And it doesn't arise out of a kind of ruminative, obsessive thinking, like I'm going to figure out this problem that I have. I have these patterns and I'm going to understand it. I'm just going to sit and just like, why do you keep doing this, Matthew? Right? Insight is, it like bubbles out of the quiet, out of the continuity of awareness, when we're not missing the chapters as we've been talking about. And it usually, the kind of insights that are transformative, they usually have a strong somatic, emotional, bodily fingerprint. It's like the insights like making it harder for us to forget. Insights, I think, they can really become a kind of touchstone in a way. They reconnect us even after the insight is gone, and maybe we're not experientially seeing in that same way. We can still actually remember back, and it connects us to a way of being. It connects us really to our own wisdom. Insights are a way of reconnecting to our own wisdom, because we forget, you know. I have a friend who teaches, Dharma teacher, and he said we were talking about this habit of forgetting, kind of like forgetting what we know. And he said sometimes he'll listen to like a Dharma talk he's given, you know, that's been recorded or something, and he'll listen to it and he'll think like, that guy sounds like he knows what he's talking about. I don't know, but that guy kind of sounds like he knows, right? And there's a way we get kind of, the insight is both, it's durable, but it also is like prone to times when we just feel so disconnected from it. And then we touch back in and retreat. The silence can be a way of touching back into something we knew that was meaningful, connecting us back into a whole different way of relating to our life. Now, again, this is a point that I really appreciate, again, from Rob Berbia, said that insights, it's rare for an insight to be just seen once and then it has some definitive enduring effects that transforms much of our life. That does happen, but that's very uncommon, I would say. And more common is the need for insights to be repeated, to be revisited. And sometimes for us to act as if the insight were true, even when we're no longer believing it. So like, I know this shame is empty. I know this, and you can fill in the blank, is empty. But right now, it's as real as anything. Yeah. Right. How do we practice that insight? We can try to live as if the insight were true, even though there's something in us that's saying no. It's like we're experimenting with insights, acting them out, starting to put our kind of behavior in alignment with wisdom. So generally, if I needed to break down kind of three forms of insight, I would say the first would be personal insight, meaning that even though we're similar in a million ways, our conditioning is also very personal. I saw this very clearly one time. I was teaching a course that was where it was a very small course. It was five people and working quite intensively with them, and it was online, and I sort of had a syllabus in mind, but because I was working individually with them, it was possible to really tailor what was happening for each individual. And I wound up feeling like I was teaching five totally different classes based on the kind of conditions of the sort of personal style and habits and mind of the five participants, right? And then I would go maybe give a Dharma talk to a group, and I would say the same thing to 100 people. And it was like, right now I'm saying it to 40, the same thing. But I was like, I don't know about this whole kind of like one size fits all model. You know, it was like such kind of idiosyncratic, you know, personal style and differences. And I think we all come to the Dharma sharing so much, but also with our own very particular conditioning. The ways we suffer, how we're going to get freer, is very personal. And so this personal level of insight, we really, we want to get to know maybe first our bodies, our pleasures and our pains. We want to get to know our desire, what we long for. You know, for some of us, to desire is a very vulnerable thing, complicated business. We want to get to know our bodies and the innocence of our bodies, the innocence of our conditioning. We want to know how experience manifests in our body. What emotion feels like, what anger or love feels like. We want to know our kind of system of energy and how it works, how the rhythms of energy in our body. This is all very individualized. We want to know ourselves psychologically and interpersonally, right? Like, what are the themes of our emotional life? Which kinds of emotions feel like they're inbounds, which feel threatening and dangerous? With which kinds of experiences do we tend to have equanimity, and what knocks us off center? There's no manual that spells out what this will be for each of us. This is our discovery. What arises in intimacy, in connection with others? In what ways does our sense of self, in what ways is that sense of self stimulated by connection? There's a traditional kind of personality map in Buddhism of, you know, greed, aversion, delusion, right? We've been alluding to this a bit. Well, it's now been actually adapted into by a bunch of mindfulness researchers into a kind of psychometrically validated personality measure that is based on these three characteristic types. So they actually developed a questionnaire to assess greed, aversion, delusion, and they published an article on it recently, and it was like, I saw this, I was like, wow, it was in a good journal, and it was like, based on the Buddhist prototype of, greed, hate, aversion, delusion. Anyway, it's wild to see the kind of way science and Buddhism are interacting. But anyway, this is, I've always thought of it, this is like a really primitive way of dividing personalities, greed, aversion, delusion. But it actually, when they did the research on it, it worked pretty well. And they said that it probably works well because it may relate, it may be parallel these like the basic tendency of approach, greed, withdraw, avoid, aversion, or don't pay attention, delusion, ignore. Yeah. And this can be a kind of interesting way of reflecting on our own habits. Yeah. Or do we tend to like, is our life energy focused around approaching what is appetizing, withdrawing from what is threatening or unpleasant, or ignoring a lot? These are all very personal kinds of discoveries and insights. And so what we do is we sit down and we make everything relevant. Everything that arises, we make that relevant. Because sitting and the retreat, the silence of retreat, is a lot like kind of blank screen, and then the shadow of beauty and our suffering is cast on that screen. It's like what Alexis was talking about with shiatsu, like I didn't put that pain there. I didn't put that beauty there either. And so there's a kind of commitment to of learning. This famous phrase from Ajahn Chah, everything is teaching us. And so instead of we move out of the mode of getting and into a mode of knowing, of observing, of learning. And it's very helpful to know all these things about ourselves. The second form of insight is maybe what we call universal. And we do learn that that some things seem very consistent for all humans. And the Buddha does not get super elaborate about these. These are kind of not very controversial claims, like things change, right? It's not like elaborate kind of metaphysical claims so much. It's really, what is it like to be human? Which is the question we ask ourselves each time we sit, really. What's it actually like? And there's different ways of answering it, but being human is intense. It's a big deal to be human. It's amazing, and it hurts. It's a big deal. Everybody acts like it's not a big deal to be human. But it's such a big deal. You know. Yeah. And, you know, we find ourselves... although remarkably empowered in some ways, we're like these very... tiny creatures living amidst forces that are so huge as to almost be unimaginable. Gravity and entropy, right? And there's a certain kind of vulnerability of being human. Just the sense doors are being bombarded at all times. Being touched by the world at all times. This is one way of talking about dukkha, talking about the First Noble Truth, that there is suffering. And I've always felt so drawn to the First Noble Truth, and some people think that's maybe I'm just kind of a depressive type, and I'm just drawn to the First Noble Truth of suffering. But for me, the First Noble Truth has always kind of contained the seed of the others, the other three. Meaning that when we touch into this truth of dukkha, when the heart really opens to dukkha, there's actually insight about the nature of craving and about relief, too. So there's this intensity, nothing anicca, nothing stays the same. We're living in a kind of river with no banks. A human life is a lot like that, a river without banks. And I have this kind of deep abiding fantasy that I will at some point be able to like get my, or just like wrap my hands around my life tight enough that I'll be able to hold it still. No. And but our happiness depends in deep measure on a kind of taking comfort and eventually even safety amidst the free fall, amidst the groundlessness, amidst the futility of ever holding life still. In this way, life is a kind of letting go, moment by moment. We know this won't, our life won't go on forever. I think Kafka said the meaning of life is that it ends. And I feel like the reality of my own mortality and the mortality of everyone I love, that in large part has motivated my practice to know that I want my heart to be prepared in a way. Charles Wright, our poet laureate, says, "The more you say, the more mistakes you'll make, so keep it simple. No one arrives without leaving soon. This blue-eyed, green-footed world. Hello, Goldie, goodbye. We won't meet again, so what? The rust will remain in the trees, and pine needles stretch their tiny necks, and sunlight will snore in the limp grass." Now, amidst this intensity and changingness, and the reality of the finiteness of our lives, amidst all this, there is perhaps this insight into the depth of our longing to be happy, to be at peace. And it sounds too obvious to be an insight, but what we can do is we touch in more and more deeply to this kind of organizing wish, longing to be at peace. And that when we touch in deeply, touch in deeply again, the kind of poignancy of life dawns in a different way. And the kind of respect that we have for the well-being of others dawns in a kind of different way. So this is some of what I'm calling universal insights. And then the last category, or what I'm calling perceptual insights. So there's a question like, how good can a human life be? If we have roughly everything we need and our life has, like, for this moment, worked out well, how happy can we actually be? That's a question. That was really the Buddha's question. And this last category of perceptual change, perceptual transformation, is quite central in, I think, the more radical forms of well-being. So Alexis alluded to the three characteristics yesterday, and I've sort of included dukkha, suffering, and anicca in the previous category, but I left out anatta. And there's this I heard this from David Foster Wallace. It's a cartoon, apparently. I don't know if he just made up the cartoon, but the first block is like a big fish, and there are two little fish swimming the other way, and the big fish says to the two little fish, "Good morning, boys. How's the water?" And then the second frame, the big fish is like left the frame, and the two other fish are talking to each other, the two little fish, and one fish says to the other fish, "What the hell is water?" Right? Yeah. Perceptual insights are like that. Yeah. They're like that. This is a kind of whole, the whole basis of our view of how we really see ourselves and see the world, which feels so natural. What we come to see is that our normal mode of seeing is just one way, actually. And it's one way that is often based on attention that is not deeply refined. And that as the attention, the qualities of the attention are refined more and more, a whole other mode of being comes into view. So this is the philosopher William James from 1890. Our normal waking consciousness, rational consciousness as we call it, is but one special type of consciousness, whilst all about it, parted from it by the filmiest of screens, there lie potential forms of consciousness entirely different. We may go through life without suspecting their existence, but apply the required stimulus, and at a touch, they are there in all their completeness. Types of mentality which probably somewhere have their field of application. No account of the universe in its totality can be final, which leaves these other forms of consciousness disregarded. So forms of consciousness that have their field of application. This is in a chapter on mysticism, the varieties of religious experience. And what he's pointing to is that our ordinary consciousness ties us to some level of dukkha. This is maybe the Buddha's insight, that our normal waking consciousness, what he calls a rational consciousness, there's some friction in that. And the path of cultivating attention, of cultivating the awareness, in part is a dedication to new modes of seeing, perceptual insights, where it's more than just learning something about our habits, but the very way in which we've construed ourselves and others can be undercut. And in this realm, the world tends to become softer, more vague, dreamlike in a way, except we're wide awake, empty. Yeah. Empty meaning that there's nothing at the center of anything. It's not that nothing exists, but there's nothing at the center. And the effects of these kinds of insights is that we the kind of melodrama of the self starts to really recede into the background. Just being identified, the sense of self with which we live, that kind of collection of identifications, just that whole complex, like, makes life a little melodramatic. And as we kind of touch into some of these perceptual insights, it's a little like what I was alluding about earlier. Our life both matters deeply to us. Our happiness, our well-being is deeply honored, and there's also that, like, kind of provocative, comment I made, like, who cares about our stupid lives? Yeah. The kind of habit of living in the trenches of trying to, like, constantly fight conditions and manicure our life. It's not that we stop trying, but the desperation in that manicuring starts to fade a bit. And all the kind of definitions and ways in which we've fixed ourselves as this or that, all of those identities feel like a million miles away. Nobody gets to be the person they want to be. Nobody arrives at some version of themselves. Identity is always a little alienating. And we start to step out of that habit, and it transforms what the basic tasks of life start to feel different. So Rumi says, let the beauty we love be what we do. There are hundreds of ways to kneel and kiss the ground. The breeze at dawn has secrets to tell. Don't go back to sleep. Let's just sit for a minute.